Court is now ready to hear argument in 070522, Benny P. Phillips, M.D. versus Dale Bramlett individually, and as independent administrator of the estate of Vicki Bramlett, deceased, Shane Fuller, and Michael Fuller.
May it please the Court, Mr. Hines will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please the Court. Dr. Phillips's petition brings forth 2 points, one which deals with the statutory construction issue involving the application of the damage cap of the medical malpractice statute, and the other which deals with jury argument.
You may want to speak up just a tad, Mr.
Sure.
Hines, please.
In terms of the jury argument issue, I intend to focus primarily my argument on the issue of preservation of error, which I think is where the Court of Appeals erred in terms of finding that error had not been preserved.
Well, I want to hear your position on why that was an improper argument.
Why it was improper? Sure, Your Honor. The jury argument in this case was one that I would submit to the Court was improper because essentially what it did is it used as its common theme getting into verdicts that other jurors and other medical malpractice cases had entered here in Lubbock. Although without talking about those specifically, the argument essentially was this. Jurors in other cases had been liberal with doctors in other verdicts by either not giving enough money or not finding that the doctors were at fault, and in turn was telling this jury undo the wrong that had been done by these other verdicts, and then played upon, you know, it's pretty evident in West Texas, we're conservative, we're proud of being conservative, and then played upon the conservative nature of the Lubbock jurors and told them, hey, these other jurors that have been liberal with doctors, they've been liberal and you need to be conservative. What it does is, here's the problem with the argument. It's like Wesch. This court in 1893 in the Wesch case said, when you're dealing with jury argument by getting into what other juries have done, you do 2 things that undermine the whole process of jury argument. One is you base the argument upon what is not in the evidence, something that's now embodied in Rule 269E of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, but even worse, and I think this is the worst part of it, you're asking the jury, you're giving the jury the opportunity and you're asking them to violate the duty that they were sworn to take when they swore oath in the case and in the instructions in the charge and in this court's adopted instructions in 226A to tell the jury, don't look at the evidence. Use your emotion. Go out here and take this.
Well, but there's sufficient evidence, overwhelming evidence, as it appears to me, that there was sufficient evidence for the jury to render the verdict that it did. So how are we to determine whether or not that those comments led to the rendition of an improper verdict?
That gets into the harmless error analysis, and as we've raised, there's an issue in the case about incurable error, and as this court in the Living Center's case has noted, if you've got incurable error, the harmless error analysis doesn't come into play, but it does come into play if it's not incurable, and we believe that we have a preserved point on this. The reason why this error was harmful, what are the factors that the court has looked at in determining what is harmful error? The extent of the argument. Was it repeated? Look at the argument in this case. It starts there. He gets up and says, everybody's watching. That's counsel's argument. And then weaves in, the reason they're watching is because they want to know if they're going to be, the doctors are going to be treated liberally like they were by other juries, and that's here comes
counsel,
the objection.
Let's break your analysis into 2 parts.
Sure.
If the argument's about actual damages, there may be one set of criteria. If the argue's about punitive damages, there may be a separate set. Punitive damages, one factor there to consider is appropriately the amount of an award of exemplary damages that will punish the wrongdoer and deter conduct by others. Why is it, if the argument is about punitive damages, not material to the point that we need to deter this kind of conduct?
This was a bifurcated trial, Your Honor. The issue of the amount of punitive damages wasn't to be litigated or argued until later. This argument occurred in the first stage of the trial, where that perhaps, if it could be argued, was not at issue for the jury. Not at all. And also, Your Honor, the point is, remember, the Court of Appeals in this case, which the Bramletts have not brought to this court, reversed and rendered the finding of gross negligence, finding that the jury's finding of gross negligence was unsupported by the evidence. P- punitive damages are out of this case, and the Bramletts have not brought forth a point on the rendition of the punitives.
We have very rarely held something to be incurable jury argument. I mean, it has to be, I mean, you know, surely the defense lawyers were big boys here and could go in there and say, well, send a message. Send a message you're not going to bring frivolous lawsuits up here in West Texas. I mean, it's hard to get real worked up over something like that we don't seem to have gotten worked up on in other areas of incurable jury argument.
Is it because it's Lubbock County? Was that what was incurable?
No,
about
Your
this
Honor,
argument?
The thing that makes it, and I want to make this point.
But I mean, everybody argues, ladies and gentlemen, or all plaintiff's attorneys argue, ladies and gentlemen, I know there's a tendency not to want to, you know, award a bunch of damages against somebody. That's just the same, it seems to me. It's just not limited to Lubbock County. Why is that harmful?
This isn't the send a message that is what the nature of the incurable argument is. It's getting into what other juries did. I think we run a risk of running down a slippery slope if we open the door to tell lawyers, hey, you can get in there in jury argument and go talk to a jury about a controversial verdict that some people agree with, some people don't, and then use that verdict as a means to tell this jury, look, they got it all wrong.
Well,
here's your opportunity.
This wasn't that specific.
It wasn't that specific.
You think the jury would have disregarded an instruction from the trial court to disregard that argument?
We never got that opportunity because...
Well, you never asked, and that's another point on preservation of error. Shouldn't, in conjunction with objecting to improper jury argument, shouldn't you request the trial court to instruct the jury to disregard?
At the point in time where the judge has sustained the objection, yes, but in this case, and this is what we have urged, and I've kind of given you a handout.
Well, did the judge actually rule on your objection?
I believe he did.
It sounds like he just made a comment.
He made a ruling that's implicit. This court.
Don't you need to have a specific ruling?
You don't have to have a specific ruling anymore. Old Rule 52 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure in September of 1997 was rewritten to what's now 33.1, and 33.1 now clearly says their ruling can be implicit.
So we look at it and say, well, that's close enough or it's not close enough?
Absolutely.
And why would you want to take that chance? Why would you not just get a specific objection, a ruling on this simple objection?
I think that counsel felt like he had a ruling where the judge basically said, this is argument, counsel, he's got more latitude. In effect, counsel understood that the objection was overruled. And in terms of the implicit nature, and that's something I really do want to focus in on, the preservation of error issue, and I've kind of given you a handout. We believe that this error was preserved. There's no question it was a timely objection.
Well, do you mind if I change the subject?
Sure.
Because we're running out of time, and we've got the record, so we can tell what was preserved or not. 4590I-1102C.
Yes, ma'am.
What's the purpose of that provision?
The purpose of that provision is one that says, look, we've done a tort reform package in 1977, and as part of that package, we feel the need to cap damages as to a physician. We want to make sure that the insurers...
I'm talking about C.
We want to make sure the insurers, by coming in here with 1102C, can't come in and say, well, you're absolutely capped in the Stowers action for whatever the amount of the damages were in the underlying case or the amount of the judgment. It's preserving the rights and making clear
well,
that
what's left. I'm having a hard time seeing if the statutory cap applies, what's left on a Stowers claim against the insurer?
Damage
and I understand you say consequential damages.
Damage to
is that all?
Reputation. In this case, for example, Dr. Phillips is looking at a judgment $9 to $10 million in value now. He's got issues with his credit. He's got issues with his professional reputation. This was a verdict.
What's
that
his incentive to bring that claim if the damages are capped at $500,000?
His incentive to bring that claim is dependent very much upon how a particular verdict affected his practice. If it turns out that judgment affected his practice and essentially ran him out of town or ran him out of business, he could have very significant consequential damages flowing from the fact that the damages had not been capped as they should have been. The other point I want to make is this, though, and this is in the legislative history issue, and we've laid out in our brief our position as to why the plain language of the statute, when you read it.
Oh, I understand the plain language argument. I'm just trying to get at, there was some indication that this was intended to be a leverage against the insurer, that they negotiate in good faith. And I don't see how it could operate as a that sort of leverage if, in fact, your view prevails.
I think a lot of that leverage that you find in what's before the court is leverage that they're trying to get through a letter of Senator Schwartz that he wrote about 10 or 12 years after Article 4590I was entered in 1977. As this court said, single statements from one legislature about what that leverage was all about an indication of legislative history.
You can look at the statute and infer that it was intended to be some sort of letter.
Absolutely.
I don't need the letter outside the record. I mean, the statute itself must have some purpose to that effect.
But to infer that it is to say that one can no longer cap damages against a physician with the backdrop of the fact that physician and healthcare provider and healthcare liability claim are not mentioned in subsection C gets way abound of the plain meaning rule and also emasculates the legislative history. Here's the point. The legislative history, House Bill 1048, had physician and healthcare provider in it.
Well, now you want to talk about legislative history.
Let me
go back for a minute. Was there any desire to allow a doctor to assign a Stowers claim in settlement, perhaps?
If there was, it's unstated in the legislative history that we have available to us. At the time, there was the issue about one's ability to do an assignment and covenant not to execute, but as this court's held since then, that's void as against public policy until the underlying litigation has been fully litigated. The problem,
which C contemplates,
which C it could contemplate that, but the issue is this: what happens if Dr. Phillips then goes and pursues a Stowers cause of action and he loses, hasn't done one of these assignments, and he then has this excess judgment that he bears the final burden of having to satisfy, even though the legislature is the one that gave him the right to have his damages capped under 1102A.
If the legislature gives it, can't the legislature take it away?
It can. If there's what? Clear legislative intent that their intent was to give it away in 1102C. And the problem is this, the plain language. Chief Justice Jefferson wrote what I think underscores the plain meaning rule in his dissent and concurring opinion in DiversiCare, where he talks about straightforward statutory construction. And one of the cases he cites is Fitzgerald. Another case is Laidlaw, where this court has said, where a term is used in one part of a statute and excluded in another, the court can imply it where it's been excluded, and that's exactly what we're dealing here. The Court of Appeals below has, by implication, put the word physician and healthcare liability, or healthcare provider and healthcare liability claim, right back into 1102C, where it's not there. How can you imply into 1102C terms have been excluded and are over in 1102A. Laidlaw says you can't do that. Then, with the legislative history that we have, a legislative history that had those terms in it, and that's the point. The exclusion of healthcare provider and physician from 1102C wasn't by accident. It wasn't by coincidence. It wasn't by mistake. It was there. It was there when this bill started in the House in 1048. It was there, and it got out of there by conference committee. And this court on five different occasions, and it all goes back to a really interesting case from the history of Texas politics, the Love versus Wilcox case, it all goes back there. This court on five different occasions has had to deal with legislative history where a term in a statute has been excluded, and then a party comes back in later and wants to adopt a construction that would put those words right back in it. And this court every time, starting with the Grasso case, Smith versus Baldwin, the Maskin case, every time this court says it gets beyond our duty under the separation of powers to interpret statutes when we start basically putting back into a statute what the legislature has expressly rejected.
Let's look at the statute, and this is where I get a little confused. C says, this section shall not limit the liability of any insurer. Facts exist that would enable a party to invoke the common law Stowers theory of recovery. As I read your brief, it would only be as to the $500,000 cap. Is there a way to read C to mean that the doctor could assert a common law Stowers claim? claim against the insurer up to the excess amount of the judgment? And that's where I get confused.
Your Honor, it's in our brief as an alternate construction. Here's the point. I believe that the problem you end up with under 1102C ends up with this dilemma. And I'm going to come right to your question.
I guess the premise of my question is, even if you presume no ultimate liability on the physician because it's not expressed in statute, what is the ultimate liability on the insurer under Stowers?
I think it could be twofold. And the real question I would say to the court is, the actual determination of which of those two apply is going to happen if and when there is a Stowers cause of action. You're in here dealing with the potential rights of an insurance carrier who wasn't a party to this case. A Stowers cause of action wasn't instituted in the case. It was a health care liability claim. I think there's one of two constructions. One is that in the Stowers cause of action, the capped amount of the damages plus those consequential damages that we talked about earlier is the recovery against the insurer, or that the amount of the verdict can be used as a damage element against the insurer. Here's the problem I struggle with in terms of procedurally, if you think this thing all the way through, where the problem is. What we end up doing, if you accept the construction below, is we start litigating a Stowers cause of action in an underlying health care liability claim and start setting up the insurance company, who is not a party to that case and they weren't there. And we're now trying to say, well, we have to establish these facts in the underlying health care liability case where the insurer is not even a party.
Isn't that true in every Stowers case? Isn't that true in every Stowers case?
It is, but
how's that different?
The litigation of the facts over the application or the ability to assert a Stowers cause of action occurs in the Stowers case where the insurer is a party.
That happens in every case.
The facts are developed, but in this case, you've got the court making findings and a judgment about the application of the Stowers doctrine. It's beyond simply the evidentiary facts upon which a Stowers claim might arise.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. I wanted to have the statute available as a visual aid because I believe that the clear wording that the legislature deliberately used in this statute is very telling here. And we are certainly relying on the clear wording of the statute. Issue under this point is very narrow, and that is a statutory construction primarily of subsection C here. But you have to read it in context. This court has made it very clear. It reads, and the government code commands that the court read statutes in context. The context is critical here because subsection A, says in an action on a health care liability claim. This section, Section 11, refers to nothing else, can refer to nothing else than a health care liability claim. By definition, it can only refer to a health care liability claim. A Stowers case can never be a health care liability claim. You always have different defendants. By definition, by statutory definition, a health care liability claim always has to be against a medical provider. A Stowers case, by common law definition, always has to be against an insurer. So a Stowers action can never be a healthcare liability claim. But it says in an action on a healthcare liability claim, and it goes on. Now, subsection C says this section, which has to refer under the government code to section 11 in toto, says this section shall not. Now, that by definition is an exception. If you do a Westlaw search, a word search of this section shall not, or this section shall not be construed, or whatever, you will find, I can't find one instance of any time those words are ever used when they ever are anything but an exception to remove a subclass of either persons or cases or situations from the class of persons, situations, or cases that are included in the section as a whole. It is by definition, by nature, an exception. You cannot accept something out of a statute that is not in there to begin with. And that's the fundamental flaw with the insurance.
But the exception only applies to insurers. That's what it says.
Well, what it says, and that's where I think the plain wording, it makes this clear. It says, this section shall not do something in a certain type of case. Now, what shall it not do? It shall not limit the liability of an insurer. It shall not be used to limit the liability for that purpose, to limit the liability of an insurer.
And you're arguing it shouldn't be used to limit the liability of a doctor. That's different from an insurer.
Well, the reason, and in the original file bill, and I've got, I mean, this bill was in 1977. It would follow the Keaton Commission, and it was followed the Keaton Report. It was probably one of the most important and most high-profile bills of the 1977 legislative session. The specific language that we're talking about here is not just some incidental language. It was heavily debated. The briefs contain the legislative history, the transcript. The word medical providers, doctors and medical providers, was in the original version of the bill and survived for a short time. It is very apparent that the removal of those words was for a specific purpose, and the specific purpose that is detailed in legislative history is that Mr. Pickens, the lobbyist for the Texas Medical Association, said, I think you may be, to the legislature, you may be unwittingly creating a statutory Stowers action against the physician. And that's always been asserted against the insurer. So we would rather you leave things the way they are, that the Stowers action is asserted against, as a common law action against the insurer. It was right after that testimony that the next version of the bill took out the words physician or healthcare provider. And remained in. But it is also clear from the legislative history that the authors, when they presented the bill, still intended, and this is the paramount legislative intent that is available from the record, they wanted to preserve the Stowers Doctrine and the powerful incentives that the doctrine provides to all parties, not only to the plaintiff, but to the defendant, and also to the insurance company to settle the case, to get the case resolved reasonably and promptly to conserve judicial resources.
Mr. Smithy,
yes.
Why doesn't the petitioner's position on interpreting this statute further exactly what you're talking about? The limitation, as you, I agree, call an exception, 11.02C says, the section shall not limit the liability of any insurer. And as you've pointed out, the House version of the bill said, shall not limit the liability of any insurer, physician, or healthcare provider. Physician and healthcare provider were taken out of the exception. So now the exception to the limit of liability in the explicit wording is just referable to an insurer. Why doesn't it operate to just do just that? So that if there's an actual damage award against a physician and the physician's insurer did not treat the physician properly, breached some duties, the physician can still sue the insurer for damages that exceed the actual damages against the physician. Because as the exception, and I agree you rightly says the Stowers Doctrine can continue to be applied in those cases and not limit the liability of any insurer. So it seems to operate properly in the petitioner's view. Why is that not right?
Two reasons, Judge, very clearly. One is if you look at the enactment itself in House Bill 1048, and it was in the statute. Incidentally, this is repealed now. It was replaced in 2003. In 30 years or so, there were only this and one other reported case that we could find under this provision, and I don't know of any more in the pipeline. So it's really a dead issue after this case leaves this court.
There's still a provision on that point in 303, right?
There is, but Your Honor, it was of course recodified as part of House Bill 4 in 2003. But it was substantively amended at that point. And clearly, in that legislative history in 2003, the legislature passed a different provision to yield a different result, so which is essentially the result
that,
they want.
Your view of that change is that it would not support your position here.
The new language, and I don't think it's particularly relevant here, but no, I think it was substantively amended later on.
So again, my Question, okay. Subsection C, if you say it just applies to the word insurer, to the entity insurers, that their liability is not limited in a Stowers context, then that seems to be entirely consistent with the language, because a physician with an actual damage award can still sue his insurer or her insurer if the insurer breached duties and caused damages.
Well, let me tell you two reasons why I disagree with that statement, Your Honor. First of all is the enactment itself. If you'll look at section 1.02B7 of Article 4590I, that's now repealed, if you'll look at that, what you will see is the legislature stated in very explicit terms that it, by the enactment of House Bill 1048 and the effectiveness of Article 4590A, you will see very specific language that says we do not intend to impact any other area of tort law by this bill. So the legislature said that. I mean, the legislature specifically said we're not impacting anything other than a medical healthcare liability suit. So first of all, if the court were to hold that way, it would be basically doing what the legislature said we're not doing here. But secondly, in a traditional Stowers action, you got three parties. Three groups of parties anyway. Two of them were negligent. The tortfeasor was negligent in committing the tort, and the insurer was negligent in not settling the case. You've got one victim who has very likely no negligence at all. Now, why would you want to reward the tortfeasor here, particularly in a case where he either committed or bordered?
That goes to all caps. Why would you ever want to? Because the legislature said so is why.
And the legislature, there's no general right to have your damages limited. And just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you're entitled to limited damage any more than a lawyer or an architect. The justification
seems to help at the legislature, though.
Pardon?
Seems to help at the legislature.
Well, and that's
true.
They
haven't kept damages
for
lawyers,
have they?
They've
done very well. Doctors have done very well in the legislature, but the justification for that, at least the justification the legislature states in the statute when it does that, it says, for instance, in 77, we got a health care insurance crisis. Doctors can't get insurance. So we've got a public policy where we either go to police power or something very similar to police power, and so we're going to override the basic
rules. I interrupted you. Your first argument was, why would you want to help a tortfeasor? And the answer to that is because that's what caps do.
Well, caps do
reward.
What's
the second argument?
Caps do reward to some extent, but you're rewarding the tortfeasor not only with the absence or a limit of liability, you're rewarding with a windfall when this is all over, because he asserts the tortfeasor asserts the Stowers damage, receives $10 or $11 million if you base it on the jury verdict, and that's not good public policy.
And that's my question. That's where I get hung up.
Yes.
Is what do you pin Stowers liability on in light of the cap? Is it? I mean, why would an insurer ever insure a physician for more than $500,000?
Well, they wouldn't.
Okay. So it seems to me that the Stowers liability would be very, very limited. It would only be if the insurer did not accept an offer, let's say, of $300,000, and the verdict comes back at $10 million, but it's capped at $5 million, the most the insurer is ever going to be liable for is $200,000.
Exactly.
Stowers
it's just going to – those very rare cases where you would have a verdict between the offer and the cap. Be very rare cases.
So no one's arguing then that the cap wouldn't apply in the Stowers context. That if there's a verdict of $10 million, somehow the insurer is going to be liable for the difference between the cap and the recovery. No one's arguing that.
No, I mean, there could potentially be some liability in that situation.
What other liability? Are we talking about damage to the physician's practice or what? In addition to that limited amount, that $200,000 that just...
That's all. It's just that those basic special elements of damage to
so the cap will always apply, and the most the insurer would ever be liable for under the Stowers doctrine would be $500,000.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the most. And see,
What about the other damages, to reputation of the doctor, things like that, even if it's capped? Don't you still have those out there?
You would either with or without this statute. And that's okay. That's the other argument, is that if you take that approach, and incidentally, back to the argument on a subsequent Stowers action, I mean, that's the damages are established at this court. Well, the Court of Appeals said in Allstate versus Kelly, and this court has in the Gandy case, and also in the Rocor, in one of the in Justice Baker's concurring opinion, the court basically said that damages in a Stowers case are the amount of the excess judgment as a matter of law. So anyway, that would be a substantive change when you say no. Instead of the judgment, you can use the jury verdict.
However, in bad faith insurance actions like Stowers actions, there's punitive damages available. There's statutory penalties and interest. There's attorney's fees.
Yeah.
The damages will very often exceed the difference between the settlement that should have been accepted and wasn't.
Well, and that may be true. Now, this just refers to Stowers, is all this C talks about. And once again, I mean, this if that were the construction you give this to C, it would be absolutely meaningless.
Well, let me ask this. How, if you have the damages capped and they're $500,000, and you have a $10 million verdict, what's the judgment written for?
It's written for $10 million.
Then how do you limit the doctor's liability when you start executing the judgment?
Well, you don't. And that's what the legislature said here, is that we're going to accept from this general class of cases to which caps apply.
No, I'm not talking about this case. Let's just talk about a case where we're not talking C.
Okay.
You have a case that's capped, any
yes.
case where you have a cap, yep. $500,000, $10 million verdict from the jury. What judgment is entered? Doesn't the defendant move, say, Judge, you've got to cap this judgment at $500,000. That's all they can get under the cap.
That's right.
So judgment's for $500,000. That's the way it usually works.
That's the way it normally works.
Okay,
yes.
Now in this case, it says this section shall not limit the liability of an insurer. All right, so if we have the capped judgment at $500,000, if that's the judgment, how can we ever have any Stowers liability? But if we don't have, it seems to me like it's going to be hard to write a judgment when you've got this Stowers liability still hanging out there. Can we even have a judgment if we're reading this case until you litigate the Stowers case?
Well, yes, and I think that's why it's worded this way, Your Honor, because it doesn't say... the statute doesn't say that the court has to find that the plaintiff's going to win the or the insured's going to win the subsequent Stowers case. But if you'll read it carefully, it says that it would enable a party to invoke the common law of recovery, commonly known as the Stowers doctrine. So the trial court does exactly what it did in this case. It conducts a post-verdict hearing outside after the jury's already returned its verdict, where it finds the basic elements. First of all, is there coverage? Secondly, was there an offer, an unconditional offer within policy limits? Third, does the verdict exceed the coverage and the offer? And if those facts are present, you can assert a Stowers case. Now, you may not win the Stowers case, but the facts exist.
But then, in that case, the judgment's for $10 million against the doctor.
That's exactly
right. But that's not what this section says. That's what I'm wondering. It seems like what you're doing is you're putting the doctor in the middle, and you're letting the insurance company very possibly off, which it seems like the intent of this section, if we talk about intent, may have been not to punish the doctor, but to make the insurance company liable.
Well, first of all, you're probably not punishing the doctor when you just say he's going to have to pay the amount of damages that the jury awarded, just like any other professional would have
right.
to do in that situation. That's not an absurd result. But what the legislature said, the overriding interest of trying to keep the Stowers doctrine alive and viable as an incentive to settlement is worth this situation that may develop in some cases. Ultimately, if the doctor gets stuck for the $10 million judgment, it is because of his insurer and what they did. So, yes, that is a consequence of this, but it is a less absurd consequence than to adopt the defense approach here, which is that basically would eliminate Stowers cases altogether. And would eliminate any insured.
Well, it wouldn't eliminate it. It might encourage assignment of the Stowers claim and settlement.
Well,
because it says would enable a party
yes.
to invoke the common law theory. And a doctor could, let's say a $200,000 settlement offer was made that the insurance company rejected. Then the defendant could say, I'm gonna settle for X amount and assign to you my Stowers claim.
He can't do that, though, under Gandy, though. Because, see, if he does a pre-judgment assignment, then... it's not going to result in any kind of a Stowers case.
I don't understand why the doctor, you know, if you get this $10 million verdict and judgment or verdict, and the court enters a $500,000 capped judgment, the doctor says, "Well, I'm done."
I'm sorry.
The doctor's done, and yep. He says, "Well, I mean, you know, I don't have any more liability as a doctor under this statute. My damages are capped, even though the verdict was for $10 million. I don't have anything further to do." He says, "Well, he chooses not to invoke the common law remedy of the Stowers because he didn't have to. What then?"
I'm sorry, I was having a hard time hearing you.
I mean, he chooses, at that point, the judgment against him is $500. It's covered by the insurance. Why should he do anything further?
Well, the doctor won't. I mean, if he's fully insured, right, he owns the Stowers action. He has no Stowers.
So the plaintiff has to invoke the doctor's cause of action on the Stowers?
No. That situation will not arise. I mean, it just won't. If you look at a Stowers situation, this will only come up when you get a big verdict that exceeds insurance coverage. And it only comes up when you have facts that will enable a party to invoke the Stowers action. And in that situation, once the judgment becomes final, the doctor has a cause of action against the Stowers action. Now, against the insurance.
But that's my question. Why should he do anything if his liability is capped? Sure, he's got this potential because if he's exposed to any further liability, he'd shoot sue his insurance company for negligence.
Well, the only reason that, like in this case, it wasn't capped because it fell under the subsection C. Now, if you take the insurance company's view of this, you're exactly right.
But the doctor's liability is capped, right?
Because I'm sorry?
The doctor's liability is capped.
No, it's not. Because C is an exception to the general caps that are in A.
Well, it's an exception for the insurer, liability of any insurer.
But if you'll follow that, what it says, it shall not limit the liability. It shall not be used for a specific purpose.
The statute compels the doctor to invoke the Stowers doctrine because it says enable a party to invoke. In other words, what if the doctor just said, $500,000, my liability is capped, I'm not going against my insurer, even though they unreasonably denied settlement, you know, when settlement could have been done. What you're saying is it doesn't matter if the doctor wouldn't have pursued that because the statute says it would enable a party to invoke.
That
therefore eliminates really the $500,000 cap in entitlement.
Those cases, yes, you're right. It eliminates the cap in those cases. And I think that language, a party, is very significant. Now, and it's also very significant that the legislature...
I'm sorry. Make sure I understand you. So then the cap for the doctor's actual damages can be removed based on conduct of third parties. I mean, the insurer's conduct could cause the doctor to lose the benefit of the damages cap.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if a doctor wants to protect himself from catastrophic recovery like this, they just don't insure.
No, that's not true. I think that they insure because very very seldom do the verdicts come in over the caps. It's a rare instance.
That's my point. I mean, yeah. You just say, well, I'm just going to self-insure because if I can reopen up my liability to $9 million, then, you know, if I really want to protect myself against catastrophic sort of judgment, then I'm just going to self-insure and I won't run that risk.
Well, I think that to reach that view, you have to assume that the insurance company is going to breach its obligation. That the insurance company is going to negligently deal with you. And that's a very rare instance in today's world. It happens, but it happens very rarely. The more reasonable expectation is that the insurance company is going to settle, or if the insurance company doesn't settle, you preserve a Stowers action against the insurer. It's a balancing that occurs in an the statute may be written for a perfect world, but we live in an imperfect world. And this is the balancing that the legislature chose to, first of all, try to cap liability in most situations, but to preserve an exception so that they could preserve the Stowers doctrine.
Other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I didn't get to jury argument, but that wasn't intentional. Thank you.
That was well briefed, and the court will consider that on the briefs. The court is ready to hear argument on rebuttal.
Please, the court. Couple points.
Counsel, back to jury argument. You believe that the argument was incurable and it was inappropriate to say, let's send a message to doctors because Lubbock County jurors have not done that in the past in their verdicts. And you said that might have been appropriate argument if it were in the bifurcated second phase where only punitive damages were at issue. The argument apparently was made in the first phase when actual damages were being considered. Of course, the jury doesn't know there's going to be a bifurcation. As I recall from the briefing, the argument was made about sending a message in the context of an overall argument about damages that should be awarded. As I recall, the brief said, counsel said, award $14 million and send a message. That $14 million included actuals and punitives, didn't it?
It did.
So why couldn't counsel argue my appropriate argument, one that would be appropriate, maybe and maybe not, if you're dealing with actuals, but yes, if you're dealing with punitives, is appropriate when I'm talking about both and a total amount I want the jury to recover, to return, rather.
The problem isn't in the sending of a message. The problem is, as I've said earlier, I think we start getting ourselves on a slippery slope if we start allowing folks to use jury verdicts and other cases as a means by which to tell the jury, this is why you ought to do what you ought to do in this case.
So if you take the reference to other juries out, then sending a message you think is okay?
No problem with that. I think that in and of itself is probably within the confines of appropriate argument. The problem is that this case was much beyond the send a message. It was the theme that was raised was undo the wrong, right the wrong, by what these other verdicts.
So when defense attorneys like you argue to the jury about these frivolous cases about McDonald's coffee cups for $2 million and we need to put a stop to it here, that's incurable too.
I think you run the risk, and I've never made the McDonald's argument, but it's interesting.
Defense attorney does.
I thought about that. And I thought about it in this sense. How do we know what the facts were in the McDonald's case? How do we know what the liability facts were? How do we know what the damages were that the plaintiff sustained? How can one say they gave her this much money
The answer to that is because the McDonald's coffee cup case is common knowledge, and the argument would be here that defense jury verdicts in Lubbock County are common knowledge. How do we know that's not the case?
Well, there have been verdicts out here where they've stuck doctors and they've awarded plaintiffs a lot of money. Every case is based upon its own set of facts. That's my point.
I agree with that.
And my point is that you start really looking, telling the jury, hey, look what they did in this other case. And you ought to base your verdict and send the message not based upon the evidence in this case, but what a jury did in another case.
But didn't the judge basically instruct them, as all judges do during closing argument, this is just lawyers lying to you in closing argument. It's not evidence. Pay no attention to it.
He got pretty close to that. And obviously that
was
an
instruction. That's what it looks like to me.
It was an instruction given to the jury, but yet we've got the argument that the judge then condoned when he let it happen after
an
objection had been made.
The reference was made then several more times in closing, and no objection was made. Did defense counsel obtain a running objection to the comment? Why were not subsequent objections
made? He didn't
get
a running objection, but I feel like that the objection once made early on, the first time it was urged, there was no need to object because it was obvious the court was going to overrule it from that point forward.
Jump back to the statute really quickly. Way down here. Jump back to the statute. Any rebuttal to Mr. Smithy's construction? Did you hear that?
I did, and that's where I wanted to start my rebuttal.
I had a feeling.
The point I want to make is this, and this hasn't been said, but it's in the briefs. Number one, I think it's important. I think it's important for our legal system, our system of justice, for this court to decide this case. What's not been stated, and we all know because it's in the briefs, is the issue that's all involved in this statutory construction is one, as we sit here today, we've got a court in Fort Worth, the McLean case, and we've got the court below that have come to two diametrically different views over what those 32 words mean in 1102C. This court in Living Centers, and it's another reason I think the court needs to decide the case, pointed out, and although that was an incurable argument case, one of the things the court talked about was how consistency is needed in order to ensure that the ordinary citizens of our state can have confidence in our system. And when we don't have that consistency like we have right now with two inconsistent opinions that are irreconcilably in conflict with one another, that consistency is eroded. The second point I want to make is this, and I want to tie together two points that were made or two questions. One was first urged by Justice Johnson.
Counselor, if you can do that briefly as your time has expired.
I can, very quickly. The point was this. The doctor's been put in the middle of all this. But yet again, the doctor's been put in the middle of all this as a result of something he didn't do. And so this issue of the absurdity of the result of a doctor potentially not getting the benefit of the cap for conduct of his insurer is something the court should also consider, something that the court in McLean, in the Fort Worth court, noted was an absurd result that flows from the construction of the court below.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. And that concludes oral arguments for this morning in this historic courtroom. The court, again, has appreciated the hospitality of all those present. We hope that these arguments have been beneficial to the students and to the faculty and to Lubbock generally. And we will always enjoy coming back and visiting Texas Tech. And I can say that on behalf not only of the whole court, but of one of its outstanding alumni, Justice Phil Johnson. Court is now in recess. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.